of the propagator. So I will discuss the properties of the propagator, namely the two-point function phi of x, phi of y in the scalar free field. So it would be a continuation of what we did last time. And then I will start to discuss the quantization of the phi-4 theory. So to start to plug interactions. And to show how one treats interaction in the functional integral formalism. So first, let me remind you that last time we showed, by using the fact that the functional integral is just a Gaussian integration over a free random variable, which is a variable, we show that in fact this function g of x, y, defined as the expectation value of phi of x, phi of y, and I will note it ge for Euclidean, so I am, if I am in the Euclidean theory, we show that this is just, in fact, what is called the Green functions. It is the inverse of a differential operator. Okay, so it has some nice properties. And we have shown that if we go back to the real-time theory, so if we take the expression for this Euclidean propagator and you just change, make the change of variables, when you have tau, you replace tau by I times t, then you get nothing but the Feynman propagator, which is the expectation value in the vacuum state of the Gaussian free field of the time ordered product of the products of the two phi operators, phi of x and phi of y. Okay? So everything works fine. And this is simply given in this case by the integral, by the Fourier transform of the standard propagator in momentum space with the correct definition. So let me show you just a few properties of this propagator. And for that, I will just illustrate that by some drawings. So here is, let me show you. Here's just, if it works, yes. And perhaps I can switch off the lights. Is it nice? Is it fine? Okay. So here is the, this is just a presentation of the propagator in space-time in two dimensions. So I am just in the special case where we have d equal 2 in Euclidean space. And of course, I have dimension 1 plus 1. It means Koski space. Okay? And on the top, you see the Euclidean propagator. You see that the Euclidean propagator, so this is Euclidean time, and this is Euclidean space. It's just an object which is peaked. So it's a function which is of this form as a function of the modulus of x minus y. It's peaked at the origin, and it decays. And you probably have already studied the properties of the propagator. And what you can show is that, in fact, very easily, that g of the Euclidean propagator, if you write it as a function of z on some coordinate, it is just, it's a vector. It just behaves like exponential of minus m times x, z, the modulus of z, when z is large. So at large distance, it decays exponentially. it falls off exponentially. Fall off. But at the origin, G of Z is singular. And in fact, you see that there is a peak. And it's very easy to see that there is a peak. It behaves like modulus of Z to the power 2 minus the dimension, if the dimension is larger than 2. And if the dimension is of 2, there is a minus the logarithm of Z. Okay? So it's singular. At the origin, when x equals y. Okay? So this is in Euclidean space. And if you do perform the Vick rotation and go to Minkowski space, no, this is just two drawings where this is physical time in both, along those both axes. This is space. The x variable, I'm still in two dimension, in one plus one dimension. And here I have represented the real part of the propagator. This is a Feynman propagator now. So this is a real part. I'm not sure you can read it, but this is a real part. And this is just the imaginary part. And of course, in Minkowski space, so here, let me draw what I'm doing. This is space, this is time. Of course, your propagator has a singularity along the light cone. So here is the light cone. Well, I'm in one dimension, so it's not a cone, but it's a, so this is a light cone. Okay, and the behavior of this Feynman propagator defined like this is very different. In the space-time region, so this is a space, space-time region. In the space, in space-like region, let us say, the propagator is real. And that's simply because it is real in Euclidean space, and it is the same function in the real part of space-time than the function in Euclidean theory. But it is complex here. And so it has an imaginary part in the future cone and in the past cone. And you see this, it has an imaginary part here and an imaginary part in the future cone and in the past cone. Okay. And of course, this is related to causality. And so you have a singularity here. You have a singularity. Something is happening along the light cone. And that's nice. You have a singularity that you can study. But this singularity is welcome because it's related to the fact that it describes the propagation of physical particle. And of course, here, the propagation of physical particle is possible, while here, it's not possible because of causality. OK, so this singularity, your singularity, you see, those big walls here are something which is physical and which is nice. But now you have this singularity which occurs at the origin and which is still there at the intersection of the two planes. So here you have a singularity, which is of the same form than this one. So here you have what is called an ultraviolet singularity. Ultraviolet means that it's a singularity which occurs at short distance or high energy. Yes?
Causality can be relevant. The propagator is imaginary, and outside of that region, the propagator is
That's because when you, when you try to write, this describes the probability amplitude. And when you try to TC to which phenomenon it occurs, it corresponds, you see that's indeed the case. I don't have time to discuss that, but it's, I think you have seen that in some form or another in the canonical quantization course. But okay, I will come back to that later, I think. Just for the moment, just admit this statement if you don't understand it. Okay, yes?
I'm a bit confused that is the first G equal one dimension and then the next two are?
Well, there is a prefactor here. So it's not exactly, so it's just, it's not equal, of course. It's just,
so
there are corrections. So it's not exactly, of course. It's not the propagator in one dimension. It behaves like the propagator in one dimension at large distance because it has an exponential decay. But of course, you have corrections to that behavior.
So you mean this propagator is for every dimension?
No, this is the asymptotic. Asymptotic behavior. This is not the exact form. This is not equal. It just behaves like this at short distance. The exact formula is given by a special function, which is a Bessel function. So I'm not sure that the exact form is in my lecture notes, but I can give it to you. So it's some special function that you find in the books, which behaves at large distance like that, and which behaves at short distance like that. But it contains much more information. See.
So the next one is for the short distance.
So this is a behavior at short, at short distance. So I'm sorry, I didn't write it. I said it, but I didn't write it, wrote it, sorry. This is a behavior at short distance. This is a behavior at large distance.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Okay. 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 And so this is potentially dangerous because this divergence at short distance, which occurs if the dimension is larger or equal to 2, so it doesn't occur in ordinary quantum mechanics, in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. It's a specific feature of relativistic quantum mechanics. It's a feature of quantum field theory. This singularity doesn't occur in one dimension because there, 2 minus 1 is just something regular. Okay? So this is specific to quantum field theory, especially, of course, to relativistic quantum field theory. And that's the origin of both many problems, but also many very interesting features of the quantum theory in the relativistic case. And it will lead us next week to the theory of renormalization. Okay? Okay, I think that's all what I will show. Well, perhaps let me just show you, just to have a glimpse of why those singularities occur. Those singularities occur basically because, those ultraviolet singularities occur basically because when you compute the expectation value of the products of two fields in the Euclidean region, these diverge when x goes to y. See, this is divergent. So it means in particular that if you are interested in what is the expectation value of the square of the field at a given point, it's infinite. So it means that phi of x in the functional integral d phi e minus s of phi is a random variable. It's a random variable. And you integrate with this probability weight. But it's a random variable which is very, if you want, wide. It fluctuates enormously. And it fluctuates enormously at short distance. And let me show you just a snapshot of the typical configuration. Okay? Let me show you first in two dimensions. Yes. Yeah, so imagine that you are able to perform, for instance, by a computer on a lattice, you are able to perform this integral. So you pick up a typical, phi of x configuration. Okay. You ask the question, what are the configurations of phi which are important in the functional integral? And here is a snapshot of one of them. I don't explain how it is obtained, but here is a snapshot of one of those configurations. So this is an Euclidean configuration. So this is Euclidean time, and this is space. And you see, it's a very, very wild object. Here is, of course, the value of the phi. So it's a three-dimensional plot of a function of two variables. And you see, it's a very, very, very wild object. It's very, very irregular. And in fact, that's the origin of those divergences. And in fact, one can show that it's not a continuous function. So it's not a derivable. Derivable functions. But it's not a continuous function. So if you take this object, in fact, it's a picture of an object which is not continuous. It is very irregular at any scale. And it's not even a function in the mathematical sense. It's not a function, but a distribution. So it's something like a sum of delta function and of derivatives of delta functions, but it's irregular at any point. You know, the delta function is a function which is irregular at one point. Here it's a function which is irregular everywhere. So it's a very, very wild object. But it's an object you can control. But it's a very wild object. So you should not think too much of it in terms of a regular function. OK. And if you go to, this was in two dimensions. And if you go, for instance, in three dimensions, sorry, well, it's not very visible. But if you believe me, it's even wilder. So the larger the dimension, the stronger the fluctuation, and the more irregular the function is. OK? Good. So I think that's, well, perhaps I will show you some nice picture later on, but at the moment. Oh, is there a way to stop this? Do you know how one? Oh, yes. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Okay. Yes?
So are you saying then that those fields have no action and dominate the contribution?
Yes, of course. Yes, that's what I mean. In fact, of course, the field configuration with the lowest action is phi equals 0, if you want, because my action is d phi squared plus m squared phi squared integrated over. So of course, the minimum of this action is phi equals 0. But so the action which minimizes the function which minimizes really the action is a constant and smooth, perfectly continuous differentiable function, of course, because it's a constant function. But around in this functional integral, around this functional, this saddle point, if you want, around this saddle point, you have a neighboring fluctuation, neighboring functions which counts, which are also very, have a very high probability. And when you try to characterize what are the properties of those fluctuations around the saddle point, precisely what you are computing, what you have to compute are those correlation functions. And what the computation of the correlation functions tells you is that, in fact, the important fluctuations are those very wild and very irregular fluctuations. No. The action is not, the property of the action is such that the derivative term here is not enough to restrict the space of fluctuation to smooth function. Okay. In order to have very smooth function, you should have added, you know, a term with four, five, six derivatives in the action. Because then it kills the function which fluctuates too widely in space. But then the problem is that if you do that, you are no more considering the field, the quantum theory we are interested, but another theory, and in addition, a theory which will turn out to be non-unitary. So it's very bad. So you may consider a theory with an action like this term, where this is the Laplacian. So I'm sorry. So you consider a theory where you have the Laplacian square in the action and say, OK, it will be more regular. But the problem is that it's not unitary. If you try to build a quantum field theory out of that, you discover that your quantum theory is not unitary. The scalar products of the probabilities may be negative or larger than one. So too bad for physics. Okay. Okay, so finally, of course, I haven't discussed what are the properties of a higher order correlation functions? Because of course, this is not, you can deduce everything of your theory from the two-point function. You have to compute phi, for instance, phi of x1 up to phi of x4. This would be a four-point function, for instance. Okay? But remember, we computed this object using just the fact that this is a Gaussian integral. Okay? And using the Wick theorem. So the Wick theorem, this can be computing using the Wick theorem for Gaussian variable. And I think that you have seen in detail this Wick theorem in the first lecture at the beginning of the course. So If not, just ask question, I explain. But the Vick theorem states that, in fact, when I'm computing, for instance, this object, this is just given by the sum over all the possible decomposition of this. Well, let me write it in detail. The sum of the decomposition of this correlation function, this correlation function when I'm looking at the expectation value of a product of four fields, this is given by the sum over decompositions in pairs. So this will be just given by the sum of the two-point correlation function phi of x1, phi of x2 times the two-point correlation function of the propagator between those two. But then you have to take into account what's happening when you take as a first pair phi of x1 and phi of x3. Times, of course, phi of x2, phi of x4. And then you have the last contribution, phi of x1 times phi of x4, take the expectation value of those two fields, times the expectation value of the remaining two fields, which are x2 and x3. Made no mistake? Yes. OK? And this goes on for six-point function, eight-point function, etc. So, okay. And this will be the basic rule to apply to compute any complicated correlation function for the free field. Yes.
Is this only true when the action is Gaussian? Or?
Yes, of course. This is because this is valid for the free field. And because it's Gaussian. Or if you want to prefer, I would say the action is quadratic in phi. So that the exponential of the action is a Gaussian distribution. And that's only valid because of that. But when we'll quantize the interacting theory, you will see what are the rules. In fact, you have already started to see them in the canonical quantization formalism. OK? And finally, of course, I will start to introduce something that you have already seen in the course of quantum field theory one, which is the Feynman, the famous Feynman or the diagrammatic. Which is that it's very convenient to represent phi of x, phi by, it's just a representation by a line joining the point x and the point y. So x and y are points in space-time, and I draw a line between x and y when I am computing this quantity. Okay, and therefore, with this, so this is called the propagator. Okay, and there is an analogous representation in momentum space where you represent in momentum space this by a line carrying a momentum k, where phi hat is, of course, the Fourier transform of the field phi. And Then, using those Feynman diagrammatic rules, the Vick theorem states simply that if I am interested in computing the expectation value of the field at x1, x2, x3, and x4, something I want to compute this correlation function, then this is simply given by these diagrams plus this diagram plus this diagram. Well, of course, this is a point 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. So this is a shorthand diagrammatic representation of these products, this sum of products of propagators. And you have met already those rules in a slightly different context, which is the context of computing diffusion amplitudes, element of the S matrix in quantum field theory, like QED in the canonical formalism. Okay. And of course, this goes on if you want to compute higher order correlation function. And perhaps I can show you. I remember where it is. Okay, let me go on. But this is, for instance, oh, no, but it's, I'm sorry, I forgot that. Okay, so I will show a picture later. Okay, so I will stop there for the quantization of the free field. There are many other things we can discuss. And some properties of the short distance behavior of this correlation are discussed in the notes that I put on the wiki. So there's a property which is called the operator product expansion. I won't discuss that here at that stage. I don't know if I will have time, but you may look at it, but it's not compulsory. Okay. And now I turn to the interactions. And the simplest example of an interaction you can add for the scalar field theory is to add a phi-4 interacting term. And so now I start from the action S0, which is 1/2 of d mu phi squared plus m squared over 2 phi squared d4x. For the moment, I stayed in Euclidean case because the calculations are simpler, but you can reproduce all what I'm doing in a Minkowski space. So this is the action for the free field. And now I want that my field, so the quanta of the field interacts. So I want to have an interesting physical theory with interaction. And therefore, I will write that the action is the action for the free field plus a coupling constant times an interaction term. And this interaction term, it turns out that one of the interesting examples of interaction, and in fact the only possible for many reasons, is to take, well, I'm in 4 dimensions, but I could be in d-dimension, is a term of proportional to the square of the field at a given point. And for reasons which will appear clear later, I introduce a normalization factor, which is 1/4. But it's just a normalization at the moment. Okay, and this is, of course, this coupling is the coupling constant. It is the strength of the interaction between the quanta of the field. And you may guess that this coupling constant has to be positive Because the action, you want the action that the, you want the action to be bounded from below. And if G is negative, the action is not bounded from below. Because at large value of the field, these terms always dominate with respect to this one. So to, see, if I have, if I want to have a stable vacuum, at least semi-classically, and in fact, quantum mechanically, G has to be positive. Okay? And now, what does physically this interaction represent? We will see that clearly when we will discuss what are the Feynman diagrammatic rules for this interacting theory. But you may guess from what you have learned already in the course, in the first course of quantum physics theory, that this interaction term represents a local interaction between two quanta and particles of the field. Because you see, basically, phi squared will represent the density of quanta of the field, the density of particles, and therefore phi four terms at x represents what's happening when you have two quanta of the field. So two particles arrive at the same point, colliding, and getting away. And the fact that G is positive means that you have a contact repulsive interactions. So imagine that those you have two particles, and just when they are at the same point, they repel each other, and then they go away. And it's this theory, when quantized, we describe the quantized version of just a gas of relativistic, if you want, BR balls, which fluctuates, and when they touch each other, they repel each other. Okay. Okay, so now the question is, of course, is the functional integral method useful to quantize the theory and to compute physical observable and to understand what are the physical properties of this theory? So, of course, what we would like to do is just to apply the rule of path integral quantization and of functional integral quantization to this new theory, which is an interacting theory, and to see whether it works. So that's the general strategy of. Let us just apply the rule, if you want, or the law of functional integral quantization. Just apply boldly the rule and see whether it gives a sensible result. And we shall see that it gives sensible results, but for the problem of those ultraviolet singularities, which requires some care, which is the process of renormalization. So they work. So the answer to that is that it will work, but you have to apply it carefully, not very stupid way. It's not so. It's like, if you want to cook an egg and you know the recipe to cook a piece of meat in an oven. If you just put the egg in the oven and turn it off, it will be a disaster. You have to make some fine tuning until you understood how to cook an egg in an oven, which is a stupid thing to do anyway. Okay. So apply the rules means simply that I will define the partition function, if you want, of this interacting theory exactly that I did before as exponential of minus 1 over h bar se of phi. So s of phi, where s of phi is now the sum of the free field term and of the interaction. Okay? So I am doing the calculation in the Euclidean regime because there are no nasty I factor, but everything can be done directly in Minkowski space. So I have to compute something like that. And for instance, if I want to compute what is the correlation function of two fields in this interacting theory, I have to apply the same thing. I just have to compute what is the functional integral of exponential of minus 1 over h bar times the action times phi of x1, phi of x2. And I have to divide by z. S of phi, that's the rule. Okay. But now, of course, here, here, and here, I have to use the full action of the theory with the interaction term. You see? So the basic idea, which goes back to the first development of quantum field theory and of quantum electrodynamics in the 30s, if you want a bit of history, immediately after physicists invented quantum mechanics in its modern form, they immediately applied it and they tried to quantize the electromagnetic field. And this was done even, I think, the first paper were by Heisenberg and Jordan or someone else in 1929. So it was really, really. So it's a very, very early attempt. And then the idea, of course, is since it's a very complicated problem, is to assume that the coupling constant is very small, in a sense that I will not define. So it's small. And therefore, just to try to treat it as a perturbation. Treat the phi 4 term as a small perturbation. So there is a theory we know very well, which is the free field theory. Now we have seen that we can basically compute everything, because everything reduces to computing two-point functions. And so we can say, okay, so if the interaction is weak, we can just look at what's happening, for instance, at first order in the coupling constant. That's a natural idea, which works quite well for quantum electrodynamics, because quantum electrodynamics, the coupling constant is this famous alpha equal 1 over 137 and some figure after that. So it's really a small number. And it works very well. So the idea is to perform what is called develop perturbation theory. And the idea of perturbation theory is to express the physical quantity like that, express those quantities here that we are interested in, as power series in G, the coupling constant. And keep, for instance, just the first order, the term of order G, or the term of order G, and the term of order G squared. So we expand in powers of the interaction. Okay? So with the with a functional integral formalism, that's very simple, because we can write, for instance, the coupling constant z as
integral d phi exponential minus 1 over h bar s naught of phi times exponential minus g over factorial 4 times h bar integral of dx phi 4 of x.
Okay, I just separated the free term. And of course, this term, I can expand it. I can expand this term as, expand the exponential. I can write this as the sum from k equals 0 to infinity of 1 over factorial k minus g over factorial 4 times h bar to the power k. And then these terms, interaction terms, to the power k. You see, this term is equal to this one. So I can rewrite this as this, this times this. And now the idea of the next step is, of course, to say, oh, that's perfect. Let us just invert the integral and the sum. Let us just take the sum and bring it out of the functional integral. Invert integral d phi, which is a big sum, times sum over k into sum over k integral of d phi. It seems easy, because what we get is that, perhaps I will. Because then we get sum over k from 0 to infinity, 1 over factorial k minus the Kuppli constant divided by factorial 4 times h bar to the power k. And then I get the functional integral where, of course, there are still phi. But then I can also even I can write this as an integral over xk. So I can integrate over all the positions of the points, get these integrals out of the functional integral, and then I end up with d phi exponential minus 1 over h bar s naught of phi times phi of x1 up to phi of xk. Okay? So all the sums and all the integrals of points, I put them outside of the functional integral. And so I do the functional integration over the remaining part, which contains the action and the product of fields. You see? And of course, this last calculation, I know how to do it, because I can do it using the Wick theorem. And of course, there is a phi 4 of x1, phi 4 of xk. Because this is this product. See? This I can compute. I can compute this object. This. Big theorem. Is that clear? Okay. So that's what I am going to do now. But before doing the calculation and continuing, I want to do one very, very big warning. This inversion is highly non-trivial. It sounds a very simple manipulation, but this inversion is highly non-trivial because those are integrals over infinite dimensional space. And you know that in general, in mathematics, when you have double sums, very often, you cannot invert them. You get a different result. So warning, the inversion here is non-trivial. And there are subtleties. So, but I won't discuss that more at that stage. But keep in your mind, in the back of your mind, that this is not a totally trivial mathematical manipulation. Okay, so now, well, let us continue and just continue the calculation. So then, what should I have? I should have, this is mixed, mid front. No, that's not what I wanted. So let me, this is front, mid. And that's something from yesterday. Oh, but then I have I still have the wheel. Yes. Okay. Okay, so let us go back to this term. This term is obviously, see, so this last term. This last term here. This last term is obviously equal to this big integral without having the phi 4, namely, this is z naught, where z naught is the path integral, the path integral for just the free field theory. So it's a partition function for the uninteracting theory, times the expectation value of phi 4 of x1, phi 4 of xk in the free field theory. So this is the partition function for the free field theory, and this is the expectation value of a product of operators evaluated in the free theory. Okay? And it is this object that I can compute using Vick theorem. Yes?
How is it that we can separate the path integral from, it just looks to me when I look at that expression that if I separate the path integral from the phi's, then the phi's are not an expectation value that you need to put together the path integral, which is z naught, with the phi's in order to get the expectation value. So how can you separate the two over there? Well,
I don't think there is any problem. Well, there is no problem. Because as long as the thing you integrate over, which are the phi, stays inside the integral, then you are on safe ground. Remember, we start from a big expression, which is this one, where I integrate over the phi's. And here I have a term involving the phi's. Here I have a term involving the phi's. Then I decompose this term involving the phi into a sum of integrals of simpler term involving the phis. The sum of the integrals are over other indices, independent of the phi. So I can put them out of the big integral. But as long as the phi remains inside the integral, there is no problem.
Integral over exponential times product of phi is the expectation value of phi. What a Gaussian expectation value is, isn't it basically integral exponential phi? And that's the expectation value of phi?
No, the expectation value in the Gaussian integral is integral of expectation of S naught of phi, because I'm considering Gaussian integral, times the quantity I want to compute the expectation value of. You see? Yes?
I think Nicole is maybe confused. I think she doesn't realize that you just divide it and multiply it with Z naught to get. You just divided by the normalization and multiplied the normalization and then got the average?
Yes, no. No, here I have the normalization, and here I have introduced the normalization. Remember, what is phi 4 of x in the free field theory? This is just integral over d phi exponential minus 1 over h naught bar s naught of phi times phi 4 of x divided by integral over d phi exponential minus 1 over h bar s naught of phi. That's the definition we used yesterday, and we used just again here. Okay. So this means that I can rewrite this as this times this. But this is precisely Z naught. OK? Is it clear?
That's what I mean.
That's OK. OK. So but now you have to remember that, for instance, if I am interested in computing the two-point correlation function interacting theory, this is the ratio of this term that I can compute using this trick and of these terms that I compute using this trick. So you have to expand in power of g both the numerator and the denominator. OK. Good. So now let us come back to this object. From what I got that, for instance, z is equal to z naught times the sum over k from 0 to infinity, 1 over factorial k minus g over factorial 4 times h bar to the power k, the big integral over the position of the k point of expectation value of phi 4 of x1 up to phi 4 of xk in the free theory. You see? And now I want to evaluate this object using Vick's theorem. So for this, that's quite easy. Let us look first at the term. Well, of course, the first term is k equals 0, where k equals 0 means that I'm interested in the expectation value of 1 in the free theory which is of course 1. It's a trivial term. The k equal 1 term is, I want to compute the expectation value of a product of 4 fields at the same point in the free theory. I apply Gvick theorem, but in that case, all the x's are the same, so I get just 3 times phi squared of x1, the expectation of x1 in the free theory squared. See? And if I use my rules of Feynman-Lagrammatics, this is simply you have each term is a propagator which goes from one point x1 to the same point, and you have 2 times the same contribution, so you represent this number by this diagram. You see? So this is the Feynman diagram. Diagram which corresponds to this expectation value. Okay? And you see that you have a factor 3 here because you have 3 ways to associate in pairs 4 phi. So I should not forget the factor 3. Okay? Now you can compute the term k equal 2. The term k equal 2 will be a phi 4 of x1 times a phi 4 of x2 to the power 3. Evaluated in the free theory. Okay? And you can play the same game. You look at how many, where are they to pair? To group in pairs 4 phi at point x1 and 4 phi at point x2. Okay? And then, if you think a little bit about it, you see that first you can group all the phi 4 together and all the phi 4 here together. So you will get a term that I will represent by, I'm sorry, if, can you read it or? Perhaps I should. Raise the blackboard. This is the rear blackboard. Yes, is it better? Okay, so you first get a contribution where you have this contribution at point x1 and this contribution at point x2. And you have 3 ways times 3 ways, so you have 9. Then you can group, you can take 2 phi and group them together, 2 phi at x2 and group them together. So you can get something that point x1, you group 2 phi together, so you get a closed propagator closed on itself. But then you can take a phi here and pair it with a phi here. So you get something like that. And then what remains is just 2. Okay. And if you compute that, you get a factor which is, here you have to take a pair. So you have to take a pair of 2 points among 4. So you get a factor which is 6. Here you have to take a pair of 2 among 4, so you get a factor of 6. And let me write it here. So you get the factor here is 6 times 6. This is a 9. This is not a G. This is a 9. And then there are 2 remaining phi here, 2 remaining phi here, and you can group them in 2 ways. So So you get a factor 2. Okay? So it gives 72. And this 9 came from the fact that you have 3 times 3. Okay? And finally, you have one last contribution, which is this, of course, the point x1, x2. This is x1, this is x2. And you have, you can take a phi here and group with a phi here. Take a second phi here, group with a phi here. Take a third phi here, group to a phi here, etc. See? And it's easy to see that you have, so you will get a contribution, which is like that. And it's easy to check that you have, in fact, factorial 4 equal 24 ways to do that. Okay? And of course, this diagram represents the product of 2 times these quantities. So this diagram represents represent the quantity G not of the, so G is a propagator of the free field theory. G0 to the power 4. This diagram represents G0 squared times G of x1 minus x2 squared. And this diagram represents G of x1 minus x2 to the power 4. Okay? So this is the first example of what are called the Feynman diagrammatic rules that you have met already in the course on canonical quantization. And the origin is the same. It's just an application of the Wick theorem, except that here I am computing expectation value of operator using the path integral method, where in the canonical formalism, you are computing vacuum expectation value of operators, but also using the Wick theorem. So the rule of calculation and the combinatorics is the same. So it's not a surprise that you get the same result. OK? And now let me finish by going to, of course, something more interesting, which is a two-point function. Which is that if I am interested in computing the two-point function, I have to redo the same calculation with taking into account the fact that I have 2 phis. Okay, so first let me summarize. At leading order, what I do have is that Z equals z0 times 1 plus something that I will rewrite. So remember, now I take this into account. I have minus g over h bar. I have a 1 over factorial 4 times 3. So this is 3 divided by 24, which is 1/8. And this diagram, okay? And this diagram means that this represents this g0. And the fact that I have this vertex here, this is a vertex. This is called, this represents a phi 4 of x. And this is called an interaction vertex, because it's one of the vertex of the graph, okay? And now, in this, and then I have term of order g squared, but I don't write them again. And these diagrams represent just, now you have to remember that you have to integrate over the x because they integrate over x. So this means integral over dx of g of 0 squared. Okay? So now if I am interested in computing what is phi of x1, phi of x2, I have to evaluate the numerator and the denominator. So the numerator, we evaluated it already. It's 1 minus g over h bar times 1 over 8 times this diagram. Okay? Now, there is a numerator. The numerator is, of course, z naught times phi of x1, phi of x2 times 1 minus g over 4 h bar times phi 4 of x. I'm sorry, I will write this z because in order, okay, in order not to confuse the position of the external phi and the position of the internal point, I have to compute this. I integrate over x1 and I evaluate this in the free theory. So you see that the z naught disappears between the numerator and the denominator. And if you apply the same rules, you see that at the numerator, when you compute the expectation value of this, you just get the standard propagator of the free theory. And then you get a minus, a factor g over h bar. And then you have two terms. Either you apply the Vick theorem by associating the phi together and this one. So you get a contribution, which is a simple one, which is this one times this one. Okay? And with a factor, which is, of course, 3. But you have another possible way to apply Vick theorem, which consists in pairing this phi with one of the phi here, this phi with one of the phi here, and there remains two phi to be connected. So you get another more interesting contribution, which is represented by this diagram. I associate one of the phi of z1, with one of the phi as x1, the phi as z2 with another phi of x1, and it remains to pair the two remaining phi of x1. So I get a contribution associated to these diagrams. And if you count how many of these you can do, you get a factor 12. Because you can take phi of z1 and you can choose any of the four, so you have four possibilities. Then you take this one and you associate it to any of the three remaining phi, so you get three possibilities, and then you are done. Okay? So you get this divided by this. And then you see that a miracle occurs. These terms cancel this one because they have the same factor, 1 over 8. So what remains is that this is equal to the free propagator minus g over h bar. The remaining factor is here is 12 divided by 24, which is 1/2 times these diagrams, where here is z1, Here is Z2, here is X1. And in these diagrams, you know, Z1 and Z2 are fixed. The position are fixed. But X1 is what is called an internal vertex. So you have to integrate over X1. You compute this expression and you integrate over it. And this is the expression at first order in perturbation theory of the expectation value of phi of Z1 times phi of Z2 in the interacting theory. You see? Yes?
It's not clear to me why that factor or why that term in the denominator cancels the term in the numerator.
Okay. That's simply because if you do the calculation carefully, you find these diagrams minus, or let me get rid of, I don't write the factor 1 over factor g over h. Okay. So I get 1 minus 1 half of these diagrams plus 1. Let me remain the g over h bar. That's important. I'm sorry. This 1 over 8 plus 1 half of this diagram divided by 1 minus g over h bar 1 half, 1 eighth of this diagram. Okay. Then, since I'm doing an expansion of this, I can rewrite this as this big integral times 1 plus g over h bar 1 over 8 times this. This plus. So, a plus. I'm just expanding. I'm writing 1 over 1 minus x equal 1 plus x squared plus et cetera. You see? And now I have here, so I have this times this. So when I multiply, I first get this times this. So I get this minus g over h bar 1 over 8 this times these diagrams plus 1 over 2 times this diagram, okay, plus this terms, which is over the g, times this term, which is over the 1. So I get plus g over h bar, 1 over 8, this terms times this terms. You see? And then I know that the remaining term are order g squared. And you see that here you have a minus g over 8, and here you have a plus g over 8. So this term cancel this term. Okay? Okay, and so finally, just to finish by a few pictures, these are the rules of the game. You can compute any correlation function by just applying the Vick theorem, looking at all the possible combination, counting how many ways you can construct a given diagram, combine everything and re-express everything in terms of this diagrammatic expansion, where each diagram, in fact, represents an integral over x of combination of function involving the x and the z's. For instance, this term, of course, that I didn't write explicitly, but what represents this term? This represents integral over the position of the internal vertex x1 here. Here I have z1 and z2. This propagator represents g of z1 minus x. This propagator represents g of x minus z2. And this propagator represents g of 0. So is given by this integral. You see? And this propagator represents minus g over h bar. Okay? And just to finish by showing you a bit of diagrammatics. There must be a way to. No, it's too light. Light, low. Yes, light, low. Okay. What's going on? Yes. Okay. So here you recognize. Here you recognize the diagram I computed on the blackboard for the vacuum. The partition function for Z. Here is an explanation of why you get factor 3 that I will skip. Here are the diagram for the two-point correlation function in the free theory and the two diagrams we computed on the blackboard. Here you see that, in fact, here are the two diagrams which survives when you compute this expectation value. And now if you continue at second order, you start to have a proliferation of diagrams for the two-point functions. And some of them you recognize as diagrams you have already met in the calculation of the partition function. But some of them, this one and this one, are new. And in fact, when you compute the, at second order, the two-point correlation function, it's only the connected diagram which survives. So these diagrams, and these diagrams. And finally, if you are interested in computing the four-point correlation function, the four-point correlation for the free theory is given by this four combination of propagators. This is just a Vick theorem. If you want to compute it at first order in the coupling constant by inserting a G phi 4, then you get a proliferation of diagram. But in particular, you get this diagram where this represents the phi 4, and each of the phi is paired with one of the phi 4. So that's an interesting diagram because all the other ones have already been obtained. And you see, so this is the interesting diagram. And finally, if you keep only the connected diagram, so the diagrams which have no external part, these are the diagrams for the vacuum, for the partition function. These are the diagrams which are connected and which play the role in the two-point function. And these are the diagrams. Okay, and they can be decomposed. That's something I will explain tomorrow. Here is the diagrams which intervene, which play a role in the four-point function. So you see that all the vacuum diagrams has disappeared. So exactly like in the four-point function, this diagram, which was a diagram of the partition function, has disappeared. This repeats for the four-point function. But there are diagrams which are not connected. And among the diagrams which are connected, there is only one diagram which plays a role for the four-point function, which is a diagram where you have two particles incoming, interacting at a given point, and then outcoming in a different state. So that's a diagram you have, encountered in the canonical quantization course. And if you like to be a bit more, here are all the possible connected diagrams which appears as second order in the interaction, so order G squared, and you see you start to have a flurry of them because you have a diagram where the propagation of one particle is dressed by one of those bubbles, but you have also processes where you have two particles which interact, two particles coming out, interacting again, and getting out, or two particles interacting, emitting some virtual particles which interacts and get something. Okay. So this is basic diagrammatics of, and okay, here are the connected diagrams for the six-point function, where you have 6, 5, and you have diagrams like that, which is, this is a leading order, it's of order G squared, and here are the diagrams at order G3, and in particular, there is this interesting diagram, where you have the 6, 5 are connected to an internal triangle. And I think I will stop there. Yes. Okay, so next time we'll study in more detail the properties of perturbative expansion, and we'll, of course, we will, what we have to do is to study how to compute the integrals. For the moment, I have not discussed anything about the numbers that those Feynman diagrams represent. And the physics is, of course, in the numbers. It's a probability amplitudes that you compute. Okay? Thank you.